Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hey, sleep-deprived shoppers. Did you actually save any money? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Friday, November 29th. Black Friday, and it is very nice to have you with us. And before we get too deep into holiday shopping coverage, we're going to round up the economic week that was with a live chat that we call the Weekly Wrap. We've got Cardiff Garcia of the blog FT Alphaville and Neela Richardson of Bloomberg Government with us. Hi, guys.
Hey, Lizzie.
Hi, Lizzie.
So I want to start with some housing news. We had a couple of pretty interesting pieces of data, pickups in permits and in prices. And Cardiff, I want to start with you. What do you make of this? It's kind of a pop.
Yeah, and it depends really on who you are. If you're a prospective home buyer, it's not great news because prices were higher. On the other hand, if you're already a homeowner, and for instance, if you're an underwater homeowner, this is great news. It means you have a little bit more wealth. And it's especially good news if you're an investor who's already put some money into the housing market. But I think it's more important to follow actual housing construction activity, which remains kind of mixed and uncertain because that's much more important for the broader economy.
Neela, how do you read it in D.C.?
Well, you know, it's like this. No one's buying houses anymore, Lizzie. If you look at purchase applications, they've been flat for several years. So all this bump up in the price is based on very few transactions. And remember, when the builders looked at prices 5 years ago, that's what fed the housing boom. They were responding to prices and not actual demand. Let's hope that doesn't happen again.
I want to stay with this idea of sort of DC versus the rest of the world. So we've had this recovery in the stock market and really kind of moved back up to where we were before the downturn. And yet real people still have stagnant wages. We still have a lot of income inequality. Neela, does Washington get that? Do they feel it?
No, they don't feel it. They don't feel it like it's felt all around the rest of the country. They don't feel it like Ohio feels it or Indiana feels it. And that's because D.C. has something that no other community has, and that is a huge federal hirer in the federal government that spurns 1,000 industries from contracting to lobbying to lawyers to economists. So when the economy is slowing down and when companies are laying off, that just doesn't hit D.C. like it does the rest of the country.
So Cardiff, what does that mean then if you have kind of these different poles, really things pulled out like spaghetti?
Sure. So it's always a bit dangerous to overinterpret swings in the stock market. It moves up and down for all kinds of reasons. But I think there's a couple of things that might be behind it. One is that a lot of investors still anticipate that monetary policy will keep supporting the economy for a while. So to some extent, it could be that they've pulled forward in time their purchases of these stocks. But the second issue is much more problematic, which is that even before this crisis, and it was exacerbated by the crisis, we had this trend whereby the money that companies made increasingly stayed within the companies or with their shareholders, and less of it was paid out to workers and fewer workers were hired. And this is happening for some pretty mysterious reasons. Economists haven't really figured it out. And because it's been so difficult to diagnose, it's been very hard to come up with exactly the right economic policy to combat it.
So
well,
you kind of gave
problem.
Me...
Part of the problem, Lizzie. D.C. has been so distracted by its own internal battles over the budget and the debt ceiling, it hasn't had the bandwidth to look at the economy and to provide those economic policy decisions that would help generate jobs and get companies off the benches and into the hiring market.
Can't argue with that.
All right, so you each get to weigh in here. We're going to get jobs data next week, another piece of data for the Fed to look at. And when that lets them decide, all right, when are we going to take our foot off the gas here? When do we taper, pull back on their bond buying program? You guys get to each pick. December, when is it? When do they say, all right, we're tapering? Cardiff?
Stick a gun to my head.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be in December. Bernanke increasingly looks confident that he's convinced the markets of precisely what his intentions are, what the Fed's intentions are. So I think it'll be in December. But honestly, at this point, who knows?
Neela?
I'm going to go the opposite. I think Janet Yellen wants to own the taper and own this process. I really think that this is going to be part of her legacy and how we exit the stimulus. And I think that this is going to start in the new year.
Let the record show that I hope Neela's right, by the way.
All right. Neela Richardson, Cardiff Garcia, thank you guys very much for joining me.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thank you, Lizzie.
On Wall Street today, kind of a flat end to the short trading day. We've got details when we do the numbers. A company in the small city of Decatur, Illinois, has spent much of the past few months trying to buy the biggest grain distributor in Australia. Archer Daniels Midland wanted wheat to sell to noodle-hungry Asia, but the Australian government says, nope, not going to happen. This is a story about how money and food make their way around the globe, or try to, anyway. Here's Marketplace's Dan Weissman.
Start with ADM isn't just a company from a little Midwestern town. It's a giant food processing company with 30,000 employees and sites around the world. And they were offering $3.3 billion for GrainCorp, which stores and transports most Australian grain. Why? Well, the U.S. market for grain just isn't growing. Asia's is. Some Australian farmers said they worried they'd get crummier prices from a foreign-owned firm. Christopher Barrett is an economist at Cornell who studies food insecurity and poverty. He says that's not very likely. If you're talking about perishable stuff, then yeah, the wholesaler has a big advantage over farmers. They've got to sell before their fruit goes bad.
Corn, you put it in a silo and you store it for 6 months. You store it for a year.
Until you get the price you want. He says the Australian controversy was more about psychology than economics. When a foreign firm buys a big local one, people get wigged out.
But that's not always rational. Sometimes it's better to sell out a business that you're just not going to be able to compete in as effectively.
Richard Gray is an agricultural economist at the University of Saskatchewan. He says global markets make better eating.
I can eat avocados whenever I want, or asparagus, or wheat, or whatever.
And more importantly, when there's a drought in his area, he doesn't go hungry. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
It is, of course, Black Friday. Retailers are trying to make the most of the day, given a shorter holiday shopping season this year. I live not far from a Best Buy that has been open since midnight, and no doubt some of you have been up for hours looking for deals. But for those procrastinators and people whose idea of a holiday is sleeping in, as opposed to camping out in a mall, it's not too late. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more.
Renee Scale has been at this for a couple hours looking for deals here at the mall.
I bought three pairs of jeans, and they were like normally $50, and I got them for $20. So I did good. Everyone seems to have pretty good sales.
What she doesn't know is that everything she's ever been told about Black Friday is a lie.
A substantial amount of what's being offered at very deep discounts has been more or less artificially created for the optic of value.
That's Mark Cohen, professor at Columbia's Graduate School of Business. He says a lot of what looks like a sale had an inflated price to begin with, just to make it look like a deep discount. This 40% off sign lies. Oh, look, a sweater. Price is slashed. Well, you know what else is slashed? My faith in Black Friday is a holiday.
There are filler deals around Black Friday.
Lindsay Sacreta is an editor with DealNews.com.
But really, there are a lot of great price cuts on electronics, but typically lower-end electronics.
So my dreams of holiday saving aren't totally dashed?
You just need to make sure you don't fall for one of those filler deals. There are some things that we actually recommend waiting to buy.
Okay.
For example, toys are better around mid-December. Name brand TVs are typically better in January and February because manufacturers release their new models then. And winter apparel, we generally recommend waiting until the end of the season. That's when those items go on clearance.
So I should wait.
Would you like the receipt for your shirt in the bag, or would you want to hold on to it?
I'll put it in the bag.
All right.
What? It was cute. In Hyannis, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
If you're not crowding into a store today, it might be because personalized sales offers are coming to you based on what you usually spend or whether you take a yearly vacation, how many kids you have, even what kind of laundry detergent you usually buy. Matt Carmichael is a journalist who studies data. He wrote the book Biographics, How Demographics and Economic Changes Will Reinvent the Way Marketers Reach Consumers. Welcome to Marketplace.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You set out to write this book, Merging Big Data with People, and you used a device following 10 families. Explain that device to me a little bit.
So there's a lot of talk about big data in marketing, and certainly there has always been talk about demographic trends. But telling those stories just through numbers gets a little dry and, frankly, a little boring. So I wanted to be able to personalize those numbers and bring in stories from actual human beings to tell a little bit about their lives, about how all these trends that we talk about in the data impact actual human beings.
I was struck very early in your book by the shifting definition of the middle class and what that means for how we spend and what we spend money on.
Well, it is shrinking in some ways. It's evolving in other ways. And so we're seeing all sorts of interesting trade-offs start to happen. In terms of how we spend money, what have typically been competitive spaces aren't what we think they are anymore. So, for instance, I talk about a 20-something single woman in the book named Liz. And Liz had been trying to save up to buy a laptop, but she couldn't ever quite reach her savings goals because she was of an age where a lot of her friends were getting married. And so the laptop maker isn't necessarily looking at the bridal industry as a competitor, but because of the changes in our income and because of the changes in the middle class, you start seeing product categories competing in ways that they haven't before.
Matt, the other side of this is what marketers and companies learn when they look at the spending data. What are they learning from us?
Well, if you go back 30 or 40 years, there was pretty much a very typical idea of what an American household looked like. And now there's so much diversity, be that racial and ethnic, or be that economic, or be that geographic. You're seeing so many different kinds of household and so many different kinds of family and so many different kinds of circumstance. So you have to start tailoring your messages differently. But also, because we have all this new data and all these new ways of measuring behavior, we're able to target those people in different ways more efficiently.
In reporting this book, you went back and shared what you had learned with the people who you were following and researching. What were their reactions when you showed them how they spent their money?
One of the most interesting cases of that was a woman named Sandra in East Baton Rouge Parish, Louisiana. And she is a single mother of two girls, and she's burdened with all the things that being a lower middle class single mother takes up a lot of her time, a lot of her energy, a lot of her money. And as we were talking, and as I was asking her more questions about how she spent her money and how she related with her children and the things that she was buying for them and the way that was tying up her household money and her own energy, she started to realize that she wasn't really taking care of herself very well. And that wasn't just an economic thing, but in terms of her health care, her kids would always get to the doctor even if she didn't. And she started to think, you know, maybe I should actually treat myself just a little bit better and we'd all be better off.
Matt Carmichael is the author of Biographics: How Demographics and Economic Changes Will Reinvent the Way Marketers Reach Consumers. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up,
he is, to a degree, catching lightning in a bottle.
But is that enough to get one of the biggest jobs in college football? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 10 points, less than 0.1%, to end the month at 16,086. The NASDAQ gained 15 points, 0.3%, to finish at 4059. The S&P 500 lost a point, less than 0.1%, closing at 1805. For the week, the Dow rose 0.1%, the NASDAQ jumped 1.7%, and the S&P 500 gained less than 0.1%. Now that we're almost safe from Black Friday ads till next year, Best Buy was up 2.3%, Walmart raised its share price 1%, Target was down 0.75%, and Macy's was off 0.5%. The store that no shopper walked into, Amazon, gave 1.7%. Looking at the companies that deliver stuff to your door, United Parcel dropped off 0.1%, and FedEx unloaded 0.8%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Monday. It's Cyber Monday. Look, I'm not going to lie to you. If you're a stealth multitasker, this is your chance to do a little holiday shopping while knocking some of those things off of your to-do list, which you abandoned because you were off most of last week. The December session of the Supreme Court begins, and on this day in 2001, Enron filed for Chapter 11. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac play a vital role in the housing industry. They buy most of the mortgages made in this country, package them into bonds, and that role put them at the heart of the financial crisis. And as recently as a couple years ago, it seemed like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac might be big money losers for the taxpayers. But thanks to the pickup in the housing market, the government and you and I are getting close to getting back the money we spent bailing Fannie and Freddie out. Still, there's a huge debate about what's next for these two giant companies. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look at the options.
The federal government poured almost $188 billion into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac after taking them over in 2008. It did not look like a good investment back then. Fannie and Freddie's stock was tanking.
Take a look at Fannie, down about 17% for the day. Now, Freddie's stock down 18% around that, but...
That was CNBC's Diana Olick back in July of 2008. Now, it looks like taxpayers will be fully repaid by early next year. Who wants that party to end? Nobody, says former Fannie executive Tim Rude.
When you look across the table now and you've got this two-headed monster essentially burping up $10 bills, it's going to be hard to get a lot of folks on Capitol Hill to rally around the cause to kill either one of these.
So what do we do now? Is the idea to just break even on Fannie and Freddie? Tim Rude says, why not make a big profit for taxpayers?
Why don't we just milk this cow for 2-3 years, and then we could get a 50% return on our investment?
Congress is considering its options. A bipartisan Senate bill would give the private sector a bigger role in the housing market, but keep some government mortgage guarantees. Susan Wachter teaches real estate at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. She says you do need some government involvement.
We need oversight from the federal government as umpires, as validators, a role that was not played by anyone in the 2003-2007.
A House bill would let the private sector take over the mortgage market. Private investors have already offered to buy the government's stake in Fannie and Freddie. Other investors are snapping up Fannie and Freddie stock that was deemed worthless just a few years ago. Guy Sakala is publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance. He says sooner or later, you do have to let the private sector in.
About 90% of the mortgage market is government-backed, and that's clearly not a sign of a healthy market.
But Sakala doesn't think Congress will act anytime soon. He expects Fannie and Freddie's billions to keep rolling into the Treasury for at least a few more years. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
When it comes to global trade, countries only have a couple of options. They can set up shop on their own, or they can team up with their neighbors to do business on special terms in a trade bloc. It's what the Europeans do with the EU. It's what we do with our neighbors in NAFTA. And it's what the Russians want to do with a bunch of former Soviet republics in what's being called a Eurasian Union. Ukraine has a difficult choice. It's in between Russia and Europe, but it looks as though it's decided its future lies in the East. The BBC's Steve Rosenberg reports.
At the Kiev Opera House, it's a story of love, rivalry, and rejection. A poor peasant and an army sergeant are competing for the hand of a fair maiden. The opera is 19th century Italian, but the plot could well be 21st century Ukraine. This country, one of the biggest in Europe, has been courted by East and by West. The EU has offered Ukraine an historic free trade deal. Russia wants Kiev to join its economic bloc. The pressure on Ukraine to decide whom to embrace has been enormous. At the Roshen sweet factory in Kiev, thousands of little chocolates packed with nuts and cognac trundle down the production line. Early this year, Moscow banned imports of everything this confectionery company makes. It imposed trade restrictions, too, on other Ukrainian companies. Roshen's owner, Petro Poroshenko, believes that Russia has an odd way of wooing his country.
The whole world is absolutely clear and understand that the real reason is political reason. It's a form of pressure on Ukraine because of the necessity to make a strategic decision about our future development.
Last week, the Ukrainian government appeared to make that strategic decision. In a rowdy session of parliament, the country's prime minister announced that the cabinet was putting on hold the association agreement with the EU. It would concentrate instead on repairing economic ties with Moscow. Ukraine's energy minister, Eduard Stavitsky, told me that his country had no choice.
Over the last year, trade between Russia and Ukraine fell by 25%. That's a huge blow to our economy. We spoke to EU officials months ago about how they might compensate us. But all we got were declarations that Ukraine would profit in the medium to long term.
The government's decision has sparked anger on the streets of Kiev, where pro-EU protesters have clashed with riot police. Demonstrators have accused the authorities of dragging Ukraine back to the Soviet Union, and the country's president, Viktor Yanukovych, of selling out to Moscow to stay in power. Back at the opera, the maiden falls for the peasant and they stride off into the sunset. On the political stage, of course, there is no romance, just pure calculation. For now, the Ukrainian authorities have calculated that Moscow is their best choice. But President Yanukovych still plans to attend the EU summit. And he knows, because the polls tell him, that more Ukrainians favour closer ties with the EU than with Russia. Perhaps there's still time for an unexpected twist before the curtain falls.
In Ukraine, I'm the BBC's Steve Rosenberg for Marketplace.
This week is a big one for football, both pro and college. Tomorrow, USC plays UCLA, a game with a lot of money at stake. And here's why. It could help decide who gets an extremely high-profile and well-paying job, head coach at USC. The interim coach, Ed Orgeron, took over when the school fired its previous coach. And now the team is on a hot streak. And Orgeron, who was once a placeholder and a long shot, might get to stick around, if he can keep winning. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
College football's highest paid coach makes more than $5.5 million. USC may be willing to top that. And much more money than that is at stake, says sports business attorney Kenneth Shropshire.
The attention that a great head coach can bring to a school is pretty phenomenal in terms of the dollars that are related to it and in terms of the marketing value.
Ed Orgeron's unexpected success complicates the university's choice. His previous head coaching run at Ole Miss was a disaster, so football watchers thought USC would choose a big-name coach with a shelf of national titles. But winning matters, and now he's getting support from players, alums, and importantly, the wealthy fans who write checks.
You have to listen to those donors because they are the people who are primarily funding your program.
Daniel Durbin directs the Annenberg Institute of Sports, Media, and Society. It's at USC, so he's following the situation closer than most. Passionate support aside, the school needs to be sure the interim coach's current success is no fluke.
He is, to a degree, catching lightning in a bottle. And the question is this a one-time boost, or is this evidence that he has grown as a coach and is ready to take over a marquee program?
Temple University sports economist Michael Leeds says what happens on the field tomorrow will be critical.
If he wins, it would be extremely hard for USC to let him go.
Many share that opinion. A victory against an arch rival just might be enough to clear doubts stemming from bad seasons past. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
For our final note today, we're going to go from football to basketball.
It turns out that the price of an extra timeout is $50,000. In case you missed it yesterday while you were in a food coma, the NBA fined Brooklyn Nets coach Jason Kidd for apparently intentionally spilling his soda onto the court after colliding with a player and stalling a game versus the LA Lakers. His team was out of timeouts, but the mess stopped play. Kidd says it was an accident. The league isn't buying it, to the tune of $50,000. And the Nets lost anyway. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 10 points, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ gained 15 points, 0.3%. And the S&P 500 was off a point, less than 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor. The show is produced by Sitara Nieves. And Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Have a great weekend. This is APM.